يقولون سلام سلام ولا هنا سلام.
You're listening to Middle East Analysis, a podcast series taking a close look at the Middle East, North Africa region. Hello, welcome to the first Middle East Analysis of 2014. Now, that can only mean one thing, and that means that the doctor is in the house. Open surgery. It's time to go through the MENA region with Dr. Harry Hagopian. Harry, how are you?
I am fine, James. It's a pleasure being back here after such a long time, and certainly, of course, the Christmas and New Year's season. And a doctor I am, but as you can see, I don't have a stethoscope around my neck.
And forgive me, I don't know why I got all medical on that. Let's get back into academia and analysis, but nothing too heavy. This is my little warning for you, Harry, because I know how your huge brain and all the in-depth knowledge tends to come forth in these podcasts, which is good. But today, we're going to cover so much, I'm going to try and keep it to a few minutes per subject.
Please do. You're the expert. You're good at it. Keep it short and sharp for me, and I'll respond accordingly. And you'll be doing me a favor, and I apologize to our listeners, but I'm so tired that short, sharp would be much better than long and analytical today. We'll do the analysis in a later podcast.
You see, the trouble is, though, you're putting pressure on me because I like talking to you, but I'll try and keep it to a minimum.
Yeah, but you come through with that pressure. I know you well enough by now, James.
Right, fine. Let's give it a go. We're going to talk Syria, Egypt, Lebanon, we're going to delve into Palestine, Jordan. I want to have a little word as well about the Gulf, and in particular, the Gulf Churches Fellowship.
Oh, yes.
We'll leave that till a bit later, because that's an interesting one. And I know you've got a few lighter things to finish with. So,
let's be a little bit careful with all the information about the NSA and the metadata and the way we're being snooped at and monitored in an Orwellian world that we're coming into. I bet you everything we're saying here is already being transmitted via satellite elsewhere.
Don't make me paranoid, but we're broadcasting.
Don't worry, I've come back from the Middle East, North Africa. Conspiracy and paranoia are the ingredients on any menu, so I'm feeling very comfortable, James.
I'm going to take your phone off you, and I'm going to destroy it. Right, Harry, can we start with Syria, please?
Sure.
And obviously, Geneva 2. A lot of talk about Geneva 2. I could ask you about the status of the opposition and where we're at right now with that, but I'm just going to ask you to give us a little overview, bearing in mind it is supposed to convene next week.
All I'll tell you about Geneva 2 and our listeners at the moment, James, is that it's supposed to start on the 22nd of January. The whole idea is that both Russia and the United States are pressuring all sides. In other words, Bashar al-Assad's regime as well as the opposition. And that's a big word since opposition includes so many different forces to come together around a table in Montreux, actually, not in Geneva, and to discuss the transition that was promised in Geneva 1 a couple of years ago. This is why it's called Geneva 2. Now, the big question is, will they all show up? Will they show up and then will they agree on the agenda? Will they be able to discuss things politely and civilly together? And will this actually be the start of a transition that we did see a Syria minus a president who, for all intents and purposes, has a lot of blood on his hand, as do some of the Islamist and jihadi forces as well. So we see what happens after the 22nd, whether it does happen or not, and then perhaps we can analyze it further.
Well, that's the thing. We've talked about how you define the opposition, or how one can define, and how the international community can, in order to act in whatever way it sees fit. So I don't think we'll go into the pushing you to be a prophet type of situation, because I don't think we'll gain too much from that just now.
No, no, forget prophecy at the moment. Prophets are being killed by the day in the Middle East, North Africa, so I'd rather spare my life and say let's wait until they get together around the table, if they do. Geneva is a wonderful place in winter, and then after that we see whether it collapses after the first day or whether there is any sign of hope that we might be seeing the beginning of the end of all the violence in Syria.
Well, forgive me for one supplement question, and that is simply, let's say they do convene, what would be, not necessarily the best result, what would be, in your opinion, a realistic result from this?
Well, the realistic result, or the result that I would like to see, is not what the opposition wants, which is for Bashar al-Assad to pack his bags and leave immediately, because that he won't, and he is in far too strong a position at the moment to even be forced to do that. Nor do I see this as a way of sitting around the table and airing all your differences and then going and continuing fighting. If there is any possibility of any constructive dialogue by the different camps, parties, forces within Syria, pressured by both Russia and the United States together to work constructively and positively, that dialogue would be the best thing as the start for the end of this nightmare that you and I have been covering for 3 years now.
Well put, Harry. I'd like to move on to another thorny situation.
Go ahead.
Aren't they all? Egypt, in particular, of course. What else can we talk about but the referendum
of
that's
course.
Being put forward at the moment? Well, I call it a referendum. It seems to be the only one word that certainly the military wants to hear is a yes.
Absolutely.
We don't hear much about the no, do we, obviously?
Absolutely, no.
So just quickly on General Sisi, who one presumes is a shoo-in to stand for president,
I suspect.
I worry a bit about whether, is he a new Mubarak? Is it going to become another military ruler that brings about all the things that the Egyptian people did stand up against before President Morsi? So tell me a bit about that.
You know, James, you're absolutely right. The one word that counts in this public referendum that took 2 days, and already everybody is talking that overwhelming yes vote for the new constitution. The referendum was over the constitution, the new draft constitution that has been put together by 50 Egyptians representing different forces. The Muslim Brotherhood, of which the past president Morsi was a member, boycotted the whole process because they felt aggrieved. But this draft constitution was then put forward to a referendum. And by all means, the yes will be the overwhelming result. You know, this whole thing started when Hosni Mubarak was deposed after 4 decades as president of Egypt. And eventually, President Morsi became the president who was elected by the people of Egypt. And everybody thought, wonderful, this is the beginning of democracy. Egypt, as the largest and one of the most influential Arab countries in the MENA region, is charting the way, leading the way for all other countries. But what unfortunately happened is, you and I have discussed this in previous podcasts, President Morsi thought that he was not running Egypt, but that he was running the Muslim Brotherhood. And this is where he went into his own party politics, and this is where everybody else, Christians and Muslims alike, said, this is not right. We saw all those huge demonstrations in the streets, which eventually made the army step in yet again and remove him and create this transition setup that would lead to fresh presidential and parliamentary elections. Now, at that time, if you recall, James, everybody was quibbling from our own BBC and Sky news items all the way to Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya. Is this a coup or is this not a coup, or is this another revolution? Some people called it a counter-revolution. You asked me that same question and I said to you, I don't care whether you call it a coup or a revolution. What matters to me is that a man in whom I had a lot of hope ended up being a person who's too obsessed with his own party to be good for Egypt, and maybe his removal would really open the way for a more inclusive Egypt where everybody comes together, Christians and Muslims alike, and build Egypt and therefore lead the way in the MENA region. What I'm worried about is exactly the question that you asked, or rather the unstated, subtle inference in your question, which is, are we now seeing that we've merely replaced President Hosni Mubarak with a future president, General El-Sisi? And if that is the case, and some people are rejoicing, some secular parties in Egypt have already expressed disappointment and fear for the future. Some human rights organizations have said, hey, are we going into another military setup? But there are many, many people in Egypt, and I tell you, the Christians and the Copts are part of it, who are absolutely delighted that the Muslim Brotherhood is no longer there, and we have a new system which they think, after the presidential and parliamentary elections are over, will be good for them. Well, if history teaches us anything, it is that replacing one military setup with another is eventually not going to resolve anything. And what I fear is that we have only postponed the problems by a few years, and it will hit us in the face again, including all those people who today are singing and rejoicing, when we realize that, no, we did not necessarily do the right thing.
Well, I'm the same as you. I'm not so much of an expert, but that is my fear too. You look at a constitution that perhaps takes some of the religious, in inverted commas, discrimination out of it, but also it's a constitution that allows the military to try civilians in a military court.
It allows the military to try civilians in military tribunals. It allows and forces, in fact, for the defense minister to be appointed by the military and not by the new president once he is elected. There are a lot of improvements. I'm not denying that there are a lot of improvements within the structure of the new draft constitution. I do not deny that there were lots of mistakes made by Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood. But you again asked me this question earlier in an earlier podcast. You said, what would you like to see? And I've said to you, as I've said to BBC, to Jazeera, to Sky, to Premier, to everybody, it had to be an inclusive process. It had to include everybody. The military who came and took over to save the country from itself should have said, okay, all of us, we sit together and we plan the way forward, not to see again another way for the military to burnish and polish its own stripes and take over the country. Eventually, that will not work because we're moving forward by moving backward.
Well, it's a country after my own heart, I must say, having a grandmother who was born in Alexandria. But we'll have to wait and see, really, won't we?
I am stumped by that, James. I know of your Cypriot connections. Now you also have Egyptian connections. You're almost becoming my rival in this MENA expertise business.
scratching at that surface, Harry. Right, we're just about halfway through this Middle East analysis, and I think I will do a little plug at this stage, both for the Catholic Church's Twitter, which is @CatholicEW, and for yours as well, Harry, because as we've often said, you do it a bit differently, but it's very interesting, @HarryHagopian. Do check that out. And of course, wonderful, your website? Give
and
us a
my
plug.
My website at www.epectasis.net. Just Google Harry, and that's one of the first websites that will come out. And I love the way you introduced my Twitter. You know what's my latest? A colleague of mine was telling me in my latest travels, your Twitter is very psychedelic, Harry. And I said to her, just like me.
Very good. Harry, can we move on to Lebanon?
Let's do that.
I want to talk a little bit about the international trial in The Hague.
Yes.
With regards to the car bombing and the murder, of course, in 2005, I believe, former Prime Minister Rafiq Hariri.
Yep.
I don't know so much about this, so I'm handing it to you to tell us exactly
what's
going on.
Okay, I don't want to confuse our listeners too much, and I don't want to delve too much into the pages of history. All I'll say is that in 2005, a reformist and very popular Sunni Muslim Prime Minister of Lebanon, Rafiq Hariri, a billionaire who was also doing up Lebanon, who was reconstructing the old parts of Lebanon as well. He was blown up in a car, and imagine, he had one of the most heavily armored cars, and yet he was killed instantly alongside others who were with him. That's as far back as 2005. And then in 2009, it was possible to put together what is known as the STL, the Special Tribunal for Lebanon, which is a special tribunal to try the people whom are supposedly guilty of the murder of Prime Minister Hariri. And let's not forget that the son of the assassinated Rafiq Hariri is Sheikh Saad al-Hariri, and Saad al-Hariri also was Prime Minister of Lebanon for a while. So in a sense, in 2009, we started the structure of putting together this tribunal in The Hague. A special resolution from the United Nations Security Council, Resolution 1757, empowered this tribunal to take place. And finally, it is now starting its work in 2014. And as we speak now, the general prosecutor of the tribunal is making the case. There are five names, five accused. All of them are not in the court because nobody knows where they are. So it's a trial in absentia, but it has a huge symbolic significance for Lebanon, for the Middle East, North Africa, and across the world, both in terms of the rule of law, but also in terms of this almost random assassinations with impunity that Lebanon has been undergoing for years and years. And this is one perhaps example of the rule of law stepping in. What will come out of it? I don't know. How long it will last? Probably years. Will anybody be physically convicted and jailed? I very much doubt it. But there are many, many accusations and suppositions floating around. Some of them is that those five people in absentia are people who belong to one particular political party in Lebanon. Others say they are not guilty. We'll see what the Special Tribunal for Lebanon, the STL prosecutor, comes up with. But there are tons and tons of evidence to waft through, James. So this is something that's going to take ages as well. But it's an interesting case because at least it's a legal answer to this impunity with which politicians and important people and people of decent origins in Lebanon have been killed just because they are of one particular political persuasion and not of another.
We're going to head back into Syria, to Damascus now, but actually to talk about Palestinians.
I know where you're going. Go ahead.
I'm going to the refugee camp, Yarmouk. You know, there are reports there that people are being starved to death, some very harrowing reports there by the regime. What exactly is going on?
Very briefly, James, Yarmouk refugee camp is one of the largest Palestinian refugee camps in Syria. It's in southern Damascus. And Syria was one of the countries that always prided itself under the leadership of Hafez al-Assad and now his son Bashar al-Assad as being, first of all, a resistance country. In other words, resistance to Israel. And secondly, a country that hosts Palestinians. Now, those Palestinians in that camp, one of the camps in, but one of the major camps in Syria, unfortunately for them, at the beginning of the uprisings in Syria, took a position that was against Bashar al-Assad and in favor of the rebels and of a change in Syria. So what is happening now, unfortunately, as the regime is regaining some of its confidence and some of its power, and as it is beginning to clean up southern Damascus and take back all the bits that are still held by the rebel forces, what it has done it is that it has laid a siege to this refugee camp of Yarmouk, so much so and for so long already that no food, no humanitarian aid, no medicine, nothing is able to go in or come out of there. People are dying. 50, 60 people have already died. I saw pictures of men, women, and kids who are skeletal, flesh and bones, and they're going around looking for dandelions growing in the somewhere along the refugee camp to boil it and to drink as water, as tea. Can we imagine what has happened to a country where its people are subjected to this treatment? There was a convoy from the UN that tried to enter in through the northern entrance of the camp, which is held by the Syrian regular army, in other words, the regime. The regime did not allow them to come in through the northern entrance to the refugee camp. They said go through the southern entrance. Well, that was very clever because the southern entrance is where there is a lot of fighting between the regime, the rebels, and all those jihadi terror organizations. And therefore, the convoy went in, couldn't get through the checkpoints, came back again. So all the polio vaccines and all the food that they were taking into the refugee camp did not go through. For me, Yarmouk is not a political issue. For me, Yarmouk is not a matter of Arab Spring or Arab Winter. For me, it's a human issue. People are being made to die, and I don't care what anybody thinks. You don't do that, certainly not when you see the pictures. And I've seen those pictures, and you know, 3 years since the start of the so-called Arab Spring at the moment, we've become a bit inured to all the pictures. We're almost now being blasé about what's happening in the Middle East, North Africa. Those pictures, they really pricked my conscience, and I was moved by them. I wouldn't want anything to happen. You know what it reminded me of? It reminded me of the Armenians during the march and the deportations during World War I, where they also were all skeletal and flesh. It spoke to me. I was moved. So thank you, James, for raising this. And anybody can follow this by Googling Yarmouk refugee camp.
See, that's something really for our awareness, isn't it? Because unfortunately, as with almost everything in Syria, we have to watch on hopelessly, Absolutely. Helplessly, while people die in front of our very eyes.
Absolutely.
Harry, we're fast approaching the end of this excellent podcast. I'm enjoying it. Can we talk about something a little bit new?
Let's do that.
We used to talk, actually, in our, certainly in our earlier podcast, 18 months or so ago, about the Gulf states and various ups and downs in those states. Now, there's something called the Gulf Churches Fellowship in formation, I believe, and it has an inaugural meeting next week in Abu Dhabi.
Yes, it does.
And you're going.
Yes, it is a wonderful news. James, let me tell you something. The Christian church can be a little bit ethnocentric. And the Christian church, of which I'm proudly one, sinner as I am, who is very big on navel-gazing. And in the Middle East, when you talk about the church, and I'll throw this even at you now, you, a friend, a colleague, and somebody who knows the MENA region much better than many other people I know. What does the word Christians of the Arab world or of the Middle East, North Africa evoke in you? What it probably evokes in you is, the Arab Christians, be they Orthodox, be they Catholic, or be they even Reform, in where? Israel, Palestine, Jordan, Lebanon, Iraq, Syria. We've spoken about them. We've done programs and podcasts on them. We've hardly ever touched, except very briefly, on all those Christians in the Gulf countries, in places like Qatar, in places like Kuwait, in places like Abu Dhabi, Dubai, Oman, the Sultanate of Oman, a beautiful touristic area, by the way, and a place I love. It's so beautiful, unbelievable. Those places also have Christians. They have Christians from all over. They've got Filipinos, they've got Egyptians, they've got Arab Christians, they've got Asian Christians. A lot of them are migrant workers who are there. I'll give you an example. In Doha, in Qatar, there is a place called Church City. Who would have thought that in the middle of Qatar, one of the most Islamist countries you can think of, there is a place where all the churches, the Copts, the Anglicans, the Catholics have two, the Armenians, they have churches in there. So what I'm trying to say is that there is a perception, and it's a perception that incidentally is also shared by many of the Arab Christians of the MENA region, that Christianity in the Middle East, North Africa is only in those countries I've told you about. Christianity is, as we call it, in the Levant. But we do not think of the Christians in the Gulf region, their ministry, what they're doing, our solidarity with them. So this Gulf Churches Fellowship is an inaugural meeting where the General Secretary of the Middle East Council of Churches, representatives of the World Council of Churches, and all the churches serving in many of those countries, Dubai, Abu Dhabi, Oman, Kuwait, Qatar, are all getting together in Abu Dhabi, where incidentally the Catholic bishop is Monsignor Paul Hinder, a lovely man who's also serving there, in order to try and create a fellowship that actually makes those churches pool their resources, work together more ecumenically. What is better than that? Because it follows Jesus's injunction to reassemble the parts together and work together as one. So that is what is being done. Will it work? You and I know that people will bicker, and power and interests and politics and agendas will seep into it, and everybody wants to have the upper hand. Never mind. What matters is that there is an attempt to do something, and that attempt is a testimony of the level of consciousness in the Gulf of those Christians that we need to hold hands and work together. And I love it, and I've got friends there. The Anglican pastor, Reverend Bill Schwartz, is a wonderful man who is the pastor of the Epiphany Church. So I'm looking forward to it as an example of how the Gulf churches come together and work hand in hand with the Christians of the Levant.
Right. Not, this isn't a question for you now, but it is fair warning of a question that will be coming your way when you get back.
Okay.
I'm going to say to you, as I say to you on so many of these things, yes, it sounds great. Yes, I can see that constituent community that we should serve, those Christians in those states and those countries. Is it just a talking shop? Don't answer that now. Go to the conference and let me know.
I won't answer that, James. I'll tell you just one thing. Christianity, as Pope Francis has realized, and in the consistory that will take place in February, where there will be new cardinals, of which you and I are delighted to say that our own Archbishop Vincent Nichols, Archbishop of Westminster, will be wearing his red cardinal's hat as well.
Indeed.
What we do not realize is that Christianity is no longer the monopoly of the West. That there are other parts of the world, Africa, Latin America, Asia, the Middle East, North Africa, who are coming up. And that is what we should look at. And I stop here.
Very well put. On that very note, that note of celebration with Archbishop Vincent Nichols, due to be created a cardinal on the 22nd of February in Rome, I noticed that Bishop Vahan Hofhauer.
Oh, let me try that again. You try that. That's a very difficult Armenian name. Mine is easy. It's Harry Hagopian. His is
no
complicated. You know, I have problems writing it because I always mix up my how many N's and how many S's are in his surname. It's Hovhannessian.
Bishop Vahan Hovhannessian.
That's it.
Oh, I'll give myself a little pat on the back.
Don't worry, he'll give you a pat on the back now that you pronounce his name properly.
He'll give me a rather stern pat on the back. Make sure I don't get it wrong again. He sent a nice letter, actually.
Yes,
a congratulation. And it is great news for us. You personally, Harry, pleased with that?
I'm very pleased with that because he, of course, sent a personal letter of congratulations to Archbishop Vincent Nichols because they've met and he's very fond of the Archbishop, as I'm sure it goes both ways. But the interesting thing in that little question you asked me, James, is that he's also Bishop Vahan Hovhannessian, who is the primate of the Armenian Orthodox Church, is also the president of the Council of Oriental Orthodox Churches. In other words, all the Oriental Orthodox Churches, Coptic, Ethiopian, Syrian, Armenian, Indian Malabar, all of them come together in this ecumenical body called Cook, Council of Oriental Orthodox Churches. He's the president, and he also sent a letter of congratulations to the Archbishop on behalf of Cook, which incidentally I just shared with our own generous secretary in the conference, Monsignor Marcus Stock, before coming into your studio.
Harry, it's final thought time. We've probably been going on for a lot longer than you think. We're coming up to a nice rounded half an hour program, but I'm going to give you the final thought, and I believe this has something to do with eating in darkness.
Yes, it is. Eating in darkness. I love that. Eating in darkness. You know, I thought I would like to share this with you and with our listeners because I thought there's so much that one can make out of it. I was sitting yesterday half comatose to the world. Well, you and I met yesterday and you saw I was half spaced out because I still haven't got my bearings after my travels. And I was looking at the television and what do I see on one of those satellite channels? I see that there is a restaurant in Istanbul in Turkey that is actually serving meals in pitch black darkness. In other words, no lights are used. And it's not because they have no electricity or power or generators. It's because apparently they want to experience what does it mean for somebody to lose the sense of sight. And by losing the sense of sight, how can you actually enhance your four other senses? So I thought it's wonderful because you told me that you've heard of this in other parts of the world, including in London itself.
Indeed.
But it's very interesting, I think, because in the Middle East, unfortunately, people who are impaired or handicapped, instead of always being lifted up and taken care of, are looked at as being a burden on society. So this is a very interesting way of putting those healthy people in the same place and saying, look what it feels like to be unsighted or blind. I liked it. Something spoke to me in that, and I just wanted to share it with you and with our listeners. Nothing to do with the Middle East, North Africa, just part of my little rant at the end of this podcast, James.
Well, I'm going to spring something on you. I'm going to surprise you here, because I'm going to ask our listeners to bear with me. I know this is audio and you can't see it, but I'm going to do a little experiment.
Blimey, what are you going
Hold
to
fire.
Do?
I'm going to turn the lights off. If I can find my way back to my seat. Right, We're going to do the back announcement in the dark, although I should point out to listeners that we're cheating slightly because the on-air light is casting a sort of iridescent red glow, so I can almost see the faders and what we're doing.
It's nice. It's quite nice, actually, with that red light in the background saying that the studio is active. I think it's quite nice. So go ahead. Let me pretend that I'm actually eating in the dark and you can do your final announcements.
Well, what I want you to do, Harry, I want you to wish our listeners a very happy new year in Arabic in the dark, please. If you would.
Oh dear, you know, you spring so many surprises on me. You tell me we're going to stick by an agenda, and then you start asking me all those questions. Okay, it has been Christmas. Christmas is celebrated many times in the Middle East, North Africa, because there is the Western Christmas on the 25th of December, as we do in Europe. And then there is the Eastern Christmas, which is on the 6th of January. And then in Jerusalem, just to add to the complication of how many times Jesus was born and how many times he was crucified and resurrected, there is the Armenian Christmas later on. But that's because all of that has to do with the status quo of how and when you can use the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem and the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. Having bored you and our listeners with those dry details, let me say Eid Milad Majid, Eid Milad Sa'id, Eid Milad Mil'ahu Al-Farah, Al-Tuma'nina, Al-Salam, Al-Adl, Al-Mu'akhat, Lil-Jami'a. Kil Sene U'intu Salmin.
My Arabic not being what it once was, you might have to tell me exactly what you said.
But what I said in Arabic, I didn't go into other languages because we're already running late on this podcast, is I wish everybody, men and women alike, in the Middle East, North Africa, a Merry Christmas of peace, happiness, joy, health, fellowship, all the things that you wish at Christmas. I don't know what else I put in there because I just said it as I thought it.
Well, I can hardly see you, really. It's very dark in here now. So it just remains for me to say thanks very much for joining us for our
first... Do you want me to end with a Christmas carol as well in the dark?
Do you know what, ladies and gentlemen? I'm going to fade Dr. Harry Hagopian out now, so you won't be able to hear him. Thanks for joining us. It's our first Middle East North Africa analysis of 2014. And please do check our website, catholicnews.org.uk, where you will find all these podcasts and our previous podcasts if you want to listen back to those. And also, as Dr. Harry Hagopian mentioned before, his website is epectarsis.net. Plenty of good stuff on there. And Harry, when we prize you out of the United Arab Emirates, perhaps we can do another podcast in the next few weeks.
Let's do that. And James, it's been a pleasure being with you in 2014 yet again. I hope the year ahead will be a year that has a little bit more peace and a little less war in it. And come on, fade me out because I'm going to stop after 2-3 words. Laylat Eid, Laylat Eid, Laylat Eid.
Right, he's gone. Take care, everybody.